Hi, I'm Brent Clough, and today we have a distinctly Asian-themed 360 documentaries. A little later, we'll visit with the night butterflies in Jakarta. Intrigued? Well, stick around to find out. But first, we're heading to Singapore. It was questions about how creative practice connects with history, politics, and censorship, which earlier this year took 360 producer Gretchen Miller to the humid, crowded immigrant island hanging off the tip of Malaysia. Singapore, with its sketchy Malayan past and founded by the British in the early 1800s as a port town, was politically cast adrift from Malaysia in 1965. Back then, its charismatic young Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew cried as he admitted the failure of unification with Malaysia. Having described island states as a political joke, he then had to start one from scratch. Lee Kuan Yew and his People's Action Party, the PAP, achieved their aim. A country with no natural resources of its own and no manufacturing base became the most economically successful in the region under LKY's enduring political presence. But the PAP has a heavy censorial hand, both politically and artistically. Today, Gretchen Miller takes us to Singapore to look at the history of art and politics since independence and how they feed into current notions of nationhood, loyalty, landscape, and identity.
There was an authority called PELU, Public Entertainment Licensing Unit, and it was part of the police. Because the understanding was that if you have live performances and play is the live performances, riots may occur. And this has to do with that theatre groups would use the staging of a play to embarrass or to stabilise the government. And that's why plays were licensed, and the licence was issued by someone who was a member of the police. And they give you a licence, and opening night, they would come to check to see that the play was performed according to the edicts issued in the licence.
I wasn't quite sure what to expect when I went to Singapore to explore how its creative history had intersected with its political past. I'd heard all about the media censorship, the anti-jaywalking and gum-chewing laws, the recent removal of a pornographic aspect to an art installation, but it was all academic to me. So when the annual arts festival was on in May this year, I thought it'd be a good opportunity to catch up with some artists and explore some of the issues. Still, I didn't know how much the government cared about foreigners asking questions. And when the festival politely asked for a list of those I'd be interviewing, and would I be speaking to anyone outside of the festival, and could they have copies of my questions, I couldn't tell if this was to prepare the interviewees or to vet my line of inquiry. And it made me a bit nervous about planning to visit Robert Yeo, senior Singapore playwright and poet. He wasn't on the festival program, but he was interesting. At 71, just a bit older than Singapore itself. He'd grown up in parallel with the new nation and was a young adult when it was going through independence from the British, its merger with Malaysia, and then soon after, their separation. He'd been at the forefront of the development of a whole new theatrical practice which challenged the government. But at the same time, he'd also been on the government's Drama Advisory Committee. How did that work? I couldn't wait to meet him.
The plays that we see were mostly English plays by expatriate English theatre clubs, and they were mostly producing drawing room comedies and Shakespeare. These were things, plays, musicals that reminded them of home, you see. And Singaporean theatre, Singapore writing didn't matter to them. If a Singaporean person had a role to play, he would be a butler.
To find Robert Yeo, you leave the city centre on the efficient to a cliché metro service and speed into the suburbs. Robert met me at the station and we walked to his airy apartment, high up in one of the tower blocks which characterise Singapore's living spaces. Robert's adjunct lecturer at Singapore Management University, where he teaches creative writing, And as it turns out, he's fine with discussing politics and theatre. So I asked him where he was when it all started, the day Singapore was thrown out of Malaysia and headed off on its own path.
On 9th August 1965, I was in Kuala Lumpur with two other colleagues of mine. We were school teachers that had gone up to Kuala Lumpur en route to the east coast of Malaysia for a holiday. I think we must have been dumb going up to Malaysia at that time of tension. We went to look up a friend of mine, and when I entered his shop, we fell into a kind of bantering. He said, "What are you doing here? I thought we kicked you out." And I replied, "Come on, you need us more than we need you." That kind of small talk, and then things got serious. He said, "You mean you don't know?" I said, "Don't know what?" And he took out a newspaper, and the headlines was, "Singapore is out." Wow, that really floored us, you know, because we knew tensions were rising, but we didn't know that separation had taken place, and we were now sort of Singaporeans in seemingly hostile territory.
I suppose when you're kicked out of the family home, I mean, you're forced to become independent, I think you have to very quickly form a sense of self. Did Singaporeans form that sense of self quickly, and or were they a bit lost?
I don't think they were lost. I think a lot of people believed there was no alternative. And of course, the government set out to do whatever it can to create this sense of national belief and consciousness. It had a national anthem, it had a flag, it had a pledge that everybody in school had to recite. And then, of course, there were pamphlets and broadcasts. And we had to create very quickly a diplomatic corps. So, yes, nationalism was constructed. What else could you do, you know?
What about culture then?
Okay, I think what happened in the period after 1965 was that there was a Ministry of Culture. And the government saw its role, since it believed in multiculturalism, first, primarily, conservation. That is to conserve the cultural traditions and languages of the three dominant racial groups, the Chinese being the majority, I think 75% Chinese, and then the Malays, the indigenous people, and the third were the Indians. And so policies were carried out that made these the four official languages, Chinese, Malay, English, and Tamil. And all communication had to be conducted in these four languages. Now, when I talked about culture, we talk about conservation. There were performances, traditional dances, music, plays, and so on, that took place in these four languages because the government was concerned with conservation. But these were traditions that came from China, from India, from Malaysia, Indonesia, and they were traditional. You know, they were not new in the sense that they were not yet Singaporean. They hark back to their mother countries.
Not reflecting the lives of people living on this island right now.
Yeah, because from 1965 and for the next decade, the government's slogan was, "We have to survive. We have to create a new nation. Let us focus in our policies on bread and butter issues first. Let's not talk too much about creating a new artistic culture that can come later."
It's ironic that Robert Yeo's first play, written in 1969 when he was 29, was called Are You There, Singapore? The island state was only 4 years old, and he placed its Singaporean characters in London to ask that pointed question. It was a reversal of the colonially popular drawing room farces which had been uncomfortably transplanted for decades from England to Singapore. This was the first of his trilogy, three plays written over two decades. Next came One Year Back Home, where his characters returned to Singapore, and finally Changi, for the infamous prison. The plays charted pressing issues of national identity and asked strong questions of Singapore as it grew from a brand new state to a confident, benign dictatorship.
Okay, I went to London in 1966, and I was flush with working out, if you like, the Singaporean identity. What does it mean to be Singaporean in a place like London? Does it mean that you, as a student, cluster around Singaporean and Malaysian students and bring Belacan to London because you miss the food? Or do you embrace the variety that is there? And I decided that the first option was ridiculous. And so I had friends from all over the world and I enjoyed myself tremendously.
It was the swinging 60s in London.
Yeah. Carnaby Street, miniskirts. Ooh. Allen Ginsberg, the Beatles, demonstrations against the Vietnam War. But coming back to my play, well, when I returned from England at the end of 68, something was buzzing in my head. And I remembered all the wonderful talk about politics, about culture, with people from around the world. And these voices in my head wouldn't be stilled. And I felt that the only way I could work them out was it had to come into the form of something that captured dialogue. So, a play. And before I knew it, I had started to work on this play, which eventually became Are You There, Singapore?
There were several characters in the trilogy who moved from London back to Singapore. The main two, Achai, who in the second play, One Year Back Home, becomes a party member of the PAP, and Reggie, who fights for the underdog and longs for democracy. In the final play, Changi, Reggie's imprisoned until he agrees to denounce his communism in a television broadcast, a frequent Singapore government strategy.
I think the one that really made a difference is One Year Back Home, when Reggie became a full-fledged character who stands up and criticizes the PAP. But that was not performed till 1980. My application to produce that play was sent in 1978. But the process took a long time to... In Singapore, for a play to be performed, it has to be given a license. And it has to go through bureaucracy. And I remember that one time I was asked to go and see the person who was going to censor my play. And when I arrived, I saw on his table my play with red underlining, you see. And he would say things like, you cannot use the name of Lee Kuan Yew. You cannot use the word communist. You cannot use the word workers' party. You cannot do this. You cannot do this. So I knew I couldn't talk to him, Gretchen.
A hallmark of a practicing artist in Singapore, then as now, was what Robert calls the fear factor, which prevents people saying and doing things the party would disapprove of.
The other fear factor is, of course, you censor yourself. If you think this ought not to be said, then you don't say it. You try to sort of second guess what it is.
You've never been afraid, though, have you?
Well, I have been. I will tell you this particular incident, that after the 1987 Marxist arrest, the husband of one of the detainees came to see me. Now, she had been a member of Third Stage, and they were fearless people who did plays in the 80s, Third Stage. And as chair of the Drama Advisory Committee, she would send me plays of Third Stage and would seek my advice and have correspondence with her. And I always encouraged her to write plays that were about Singapore. And if you have to be critical of the government and you have a good sense of it, go ahead and do it, okay? And then she did it as part of Third Stage and found herself implicated in the Marxist plot. The government accused Third Stage of attending workshops run by Marxists and said that they had a Marxist agenda. So she was taken in by the Internal Security Department. One day, her husband came to see me to ask if I could write a statement for the Internal Security Department to say that she was first and foremost an artist, a playwright, and that she was not a Marxist. And I said, yes, I will. Then I thought about it, and this is a fear factor. I had a sister who was a teacher, in other words, in government service. I had a younger brother who was in the army. He was, I think, captain. Now, if I wrote this, would it affect members of my family? So I consulted them, and they said, please don't go ahead. Please don't involve us. And I said, okay. So I told him that I will not write this statement. But I felt awful. Here I was writing plays about dissent, and I can't even write this statement. I said, I'm sorry. I went back to my family and said, I'm sorry. I have to write this statement for the Internal Security Department. So that was my way of, how shall I put it, fighting the fear factor.
The communists who were so loathed by the PAP, the People's Action Party, had in fact helped Lee Kuan Yew to power back in 1959, though he quickly disconnected himself from them after that. As in Vietnam, during this time communism was seen as a serious threat across Southeast Asia, including Malaya and Singapore. With just a few thousand troops, the Malayan communists had managed high-level assassinations, including the British High Commissioner. The war was called the Emergency. It ran for 12 years, from 1948, and Australia was heavily involved, supplying aircraft, artillery and ground forces. 11,000 people died during this war, including 39 Australians. But what was it all for? Things were tough after World War II, and the Malayan communists, predominantly Chinese nationals, were frustrated that promised Malayan citizenship hadn't come through. And they wanted Malayan independence from the British. So did the Singapore and Malayan governments, of course, but they weren't going to get it with such instability going on. So in 1955, an amnesty for the communists was declared, calling for them to come out of the jungle and surrender their arms. And a peculiar political theatre was played out, known as the Baling Talks. The chief ministers of Singapore and Malaya, David Marshall and Tunku Abdul Rahman, met up with the communist leader, Chin Peng, to talk things through.
First and foremost, I wish to say that it is precisely because we realise that you are not the spokesman of the British government and are not the running dog of the British government, the stooge of the British government, that we have come out to meet you at the risk of our lives. I am not exaggerating when I say that we came out at the risk of our lives, because the present situation shows that the British armed forces are still in a superior position. I am not coming here to argue the question of ideology, but if questions of peace are to be discussed, we are fully prepared to do so, so that the misery of the people can be reduced. War is war. War will certainly bring misery to the people and will also bring hatred.
You can check out the talks online, as I did, before heading to Singapore, and their dramatic reading. That's what the Five Arts Centre, young Malaysian documentary theatre makers, thought too, when they ran a theatre festival in Kuala Lumpur exploring the emergency period. Then they were invited to the Singapore Arts Festival to present the Baling Talks. So it seems it's fine in Singapore to explore the political past, even if it does lead you to ponder the political present. Various prominent Singaporean men and women took turns reading the text, including writers, actors, activists and human rights lawyers.
Before my party came into power, well, they must have heard it as it was in the papers. I said that I wanted to bring peace to this country and I really meant it. In view of the disturbances in this country, the atrocities being committed, in view of the laws that are in existence to deal with these disturbances, I cannot do more than to say that if they accept the amnesty, everyone will be pardoned. That is the main terms of the amnesty. Instead of prosecuting anybody who surrenders under the terms of the amnesty, we promise him safety. And that promise, as I have said, I guarantee with my own life.
I'm Mark Tay, the creative director of the 1955 Baling Talks.
I'm Imri. I do the video projection materials.
Hi, I'm Jun Tan. I'm the producer for the 1955 Baling Talks.
I'm Fahmi Reza. I'm the visual designer for the Baling Talks.
If you were to say whether the talks were successful or not in their aim, were they successful at the time?
I think we must look at the talks in a kind of larger perspective. If we look at it in terms of what it was supposed to only do, which was to discuss the amnesty terms with the communists, then you can say that it was a failure in the sense that the emergency carried on for another four more years until 1960. But in terms of the Tunku Abdul Rahman strategy, it was very successful because he used it as a platform and, if we like, a kind of audition to speak to the British. He appeared like he could control the communists. And if he had that in his hand, if he could speak to supposedly one of the most wanted criminals in the world at that point in time, then he was a man who was fit to lead this country towards independence.
I was expecting, if you think about four people or three people sitting down and reading from a political transcript, you'd expect to be asleep in 15 minutes. But it was gripping. And I think what was interesting was that the readers really did take on the characters and they performed it, mm-hmm. and they performed it very well. The audience engaged very strongly as well. They laughed, you know, they rolled their eyes at the readers who played up to the audience. I mean, it really was very theatrical. I've heard the word documentary theatre being thrown around. Can you tell me perhaps what that is?
Yeah, sure. I guess there are different kind of ways of looking at documentary theatre. One form is called verbatim theatre, for example, where people take verbatim transcripts from court proceedings or Truth and Reconciliation commissions and they stage them.
As an example of the drama, there's this really fascinating, heated moment. The Tunku, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, is pressing the communist leader, Chin Pen, to bring his people in, to join with Malaysia and live a peaceful life and to give up their ideology, to give up being communists. And the communist leader, Chin Pen, seems to me like he's almost there. It's like he does want this to end, but there's a sticking point. The party has to be disbanded, and that's non-negotiable.
I think if you accept the position, we can proceed to any other matters you may wish to raise. If you're not prepared to accept...
If that is not an ultimatum, we can continue to discuss other questions.
I do not like to use that word, Chin Peng. The Tunku himself made it quite clear that there'll be no question of recognizing the Communist Party. That is final. If you are prepared to accept that, we can continue the discussion. If you're not prepared to accept it, the matter is closed. You accept that?
We are ready to discuss this question later on, and not now. The most important question is this question of restriction of freedom? This is a question of principle.
There will not be much restriction. There will be no restriction of movement except for the first few months when you may have to report where you are.
I want to speak frankly on this point. I cannot accept it. For the dignity of man, if this principle is insisted upon, then we can only carry on with the struggle.
Forgive me for asking, but what are you struggling for?
It is very simple. Just for the dignity of man. You cannot get success in the battlefield, and you cannot force us to give up.
This is a really heightened moment because I felt when I was reading that Chin Pen was really listening to the options and wanting to find a way to come more towards Singapore and Malaysia than they perhaps were willing to come towards him. And Chin Pen says, for the dignity of man, if this principle is insisted upon, then we can only carry on with the struggle. It's like he just collapses back into his ideology and it's theatre.
I think he tried to negotiate, and he was kind of desperate. You can hear the tone of, you know, later on saying, okay, why not like this, why not like this, why not like this? But I think it was already said by Tunku, I really don't want to negotiate, because he's also playing for the bigger role of, you know, the British will want to see, if I give you independence, I want to see whether you can handle this person. So everyone's playing a role, but I guess the most idealistic of the three people was Chin Peng. He came in trying to really, I want this to end.
In between each section of the transcripts, you had a journalist talking about his view of the Baling talks. That provided a powerful insight, I think, into the backstory of what was going on in the talks.
Said Zahari was an Utusan Melayu journalist back in 1955, and he was an eyewitness at the talks, obviously. But he's also the second longest Internal Security Act detainee in Singapore. He was detained for 17 years, and he now lives in Malaysia, of course. And we know that he had published this memoir, and he talks about his experiences at the Baling talks. So, you know, we decided to talk to him. But in many ways, it was our way to kind of return Said Zahari to Singapore.
I thought that was fascinating, and I mean, it really revealed two things. One was the fact that the communist leader, Chin Pen, was actually paranoid that he was being listened into, and in the transcript, if you just read it, it's just like, ha ha ha, don't be ridiculous, we're just recording this for the transcript, and you really believe that. And then Zahari says, actually, the whole time it was going on, the British were being informed, The responses were being analysed by the secret police. You know, it was incredibly revealing.
I think we also have to remember that every time the session breaks, Tunku's being informed of, okay, here's the next step. Now you're doing this good, you're doing that wrong, or you're doing this right. So by the end of the session, Tunku's being told, right, just make it collapse and, yeah, we'll negotiate in a few more months' time.
You point out in, you know, writing about this, that there's a number of really interesting words that come into play. Loyalty is a big one. What that is, nationhood. These words are still used today in the theatre of politics in this region. Can you talk about that as young members of these countries?
Yeah, actually, yeah. Just to pick up on what you're saying, whether this loyalty that we're talking to is about a loyalty to an ideology, to a principle, to an idea, or really, yeah, to a place. What does it mean being loyal to the place that you were born? It's only by accident of birth that you were born in a particular place.
For the Tunku, it was loyalty to him. I mean, he articulated it completely clearly. Yeah. It's loyalty to me.
Malaya, yeah, and to Malaya at that point. So I think it was very poignant and very strong to hear these words being articulated 50 years ago. And we're still kind of grappling with the same ideas of patriotism and loyalty.
You've chosen very specific people to do the reading, and by doing that, you are infusing the text with contemporary politics. So what sort of people did you choose, and why did you think it was necessary?
I think, you know, in one word, we really chose people who cared, who really care about those words that are being debated: independence, surrender, loyalty, freedom. So obviously these people come from a variety of backgrounds. They come from civil society, the legal fraternity, people who are in the performing arts, people in education, academia. And, you know, this range of people, I guess the thing that I would identify is that they care deeply about these questions happening in whatever context that they are. Another consideration, obviously, was that these people's works translate between these two contexts, Malaysia and Singapore, quite a lot. For example, the lawyer M. Ravi, who spoke as David Marshall, he is representing the Malaysian Yong Vui Kong, who is facing the death penalty here right now. So that was part of the reason of asking Ravi. But yeah, I mean, that's just one of many examples.
What I find really interesting is that the moment you decide to read these transcripts in a public space, with expressive readers, with projections, with interview material, it goes from politics to theatre. What's the alchemy here? What's the theatrical alchemy?
I think, you know, in Malaysia, we just have a massive tradition of political rhetoric masquerading as theatre. You know, the Malaysian academic Charlene Rajendran says that the theatre of politics in Malaysia far overshadows the politics of theatre. And I think that really captures it, because our politicians are so dramatic and so pronounced and so over-exaggerated in their kind of debates about the country. In Singapore, it's very different, because I think the politicians here are very sedate and quite serious and take their jobs rather seriously. Whereas in Malaysia, there's this kind of level of performance constantly going on. And also because of the language issues in Malaysia, our politicians speak different things to different audiences, ethnically and by language as well, as you can imagine. So I think these are the kind of subtext that an audience is reading into the performance.
One of the things about Singapore is that clearly it is constantly being knocked down and rebuilt, taller, higher, newer. And I think when you erase buildings constantly, then it's very easy to forget histories as well. And I, you know, that's why one of the reasons why I was interested in your project is that to keep it alive is a bit of a challenge.
To contextualize things a little bit, I think what's important to realize is that in most Southeast Asian cultures, especially in the main cities, we're going through a period where post-independence, these societies have had a very accelerated process of dealing with changing from an agrarian and feudal kind of society to an industrial society to the internet kind of age. Yeah. So with all these kind of very quick conflation in 50 years, what maybe we can say like Europe went through in 500, 600, 700 years, there's a great deal of confusion, right? And there's a great deal of unrootedness. And I think that's where these notions of history are useful for giving us a perspective on how things were and what are really meaningful. So although in Kuala Lumpur, you know, we're knocking down buildings and putting just as new ones up, but I don't necessarily see that as a problem, because this notion of heritage is something that we need to understand. What does it mean to actually have a 500-year-old building? It's not really in our culture, in our part of the world. We don't have a brick and concrete kind of culture. So that's something that I'm thinking a lot about right now.
In the heart of Singapore, geographically, historically, and rather romantically, sits an island of green. It's Fort Canning Park, a lush, compact hill rising steeply above street level, eye to eye with the skyscrapers. Climbing away from the traffic, you enter a perfectly manicured, steamy jungle. This place is the inspiration for the in-situ project, Fort Canning Hill, a performance of storytelling, music and projected images, and an exhibition of drawings and photographs, which take us further back in time, well before the communists and the PAP, to the Malayan kings.
I'm Audrey Koh, and together with Budi, we run this art practice called Beautiful Banal. We conceived and produced in situ Fort Canning Hill.
I'm June Yap, and I curate and I write. For in situ, well, I was approached to think about how I would like to map the space. And for me, I felt that the most appropriate way in terms of what I'm familiar with would be in terms of text.
Hi, I'm Budi Wijaya. I'm an artist. We did in situ to present poetic places in Asia through contemporary art.
A poetic place doesn't have to only be like in the rurals or the woods or in the cityscape. They are very multifaceted, and like different people, because of their memories or their backgrounds, when they go to the same place, they have a different encounter.
So in Singapore, why the hill and why not another Singaporean green space, you know, or building in fact?
We have been here many times, but we never knew much about his history. And as we researched into it, we realised that it was such a prominent place. It was the hill that all travellers to Singapore during the 19th century saw. If you look at the paintings and the photographs of Singapore, it is either from the hill or it is off the hill. And even up to now, it is like a conserved place, a mound. And we realised that there were so many histories. It's like, even before the British colony, which is where official Singapore history starts, the Malay kingdom, they sited palaces here, and we thought, what a fascinating place.
Tell me a little bit about the different names the hill has had and its past.
It started out as Bukit Larangan, which in Bahasa Melayu, it means the forbidden hill. That was due to the presence of the Malay palaces, and so commoners were sort of discouraged from assessing the hill. And later on, it sort of became known as the Government Hill, when the British came. And at one point, it was even called the Flagstaff Hill, because the Flagstaff was one of the first intervention that the British made onto the hill for communication purposes with the ships coming in. Of course, when the fort was built, it was named after the Viceroy, George Canning, I think. And that's how the hill acquired the name till today.
Across you know, with a view, it would become home to royalty, a handy perch to spy, a residence for administration, and a critical vantage point from which to defend.
For everyone who passed through, who made their way to the top, it meant something. Each passage would leave a trail behind it, covering the mound with stories, layer upon layer. After some time, it almost seemed as if the hill grew a little taller.
Hello, this is Sing Jiang. I'm from the National Parks Board. I'm the general manager. The history of Fort Canning Park is synonymous with the history of Singapore in the early Singapore. This is the place where the strategic position where in the 14th century, it has been ruled by the Malayan kings. In fact, the story goes back to there were five kings during the 100 years in the 14th century. I started with a king called Salina Utama. He is a prince from the nearby island that came over here. And in fact, in one of his trips, when he came over here, he saw an abyss and that looks like a lion. And that's why the name Singapura came about.
Around the hill, all sorts of leftover monuments. A large stone archway with a wooden gate, atmospherically covered with vines and peeling paint. Some elegant 1920s buildings that were the barracks and the command centre. A battle box and a sally port, reminders of the World War II battle for Singapore and the Japanese occupation. Tucked away on one slope, there's a beautiful tomb which may or may not be that of the last Malayan king who ruled from here, Iskandar Shah.
Interestingly enough, there is a certain amount of text about Fort Canning, mostly written by institutions. So, for example, the National Parks, Heritage, or those sorts of agencies. And the kinds of texts that they produce are very much targeted to tourists, not so much residents. So, for example, the maps that they produce would highlight monuments or historical events that occurred on the hill with a certain nationalist tone, as if almost it was the originary point of, you know, of Singapore. The thing is that there are a lot of other people who use the hill. It was never just purely for those purposes. And for me, that was what was going to be interesting in terms of trying to, if not find the references for, then to imagine what actually happens. So it's this whole archaic space that's, you know, full of greenery. It's about the time passed. And then at night, this place is teeming with kids who are drinking, you know, smoking, listening to the bands. And it's something that happens that officially they don't seem to talk about. So these were the two sections of time I was interested in, the one before and right now.
At any one time on the top of the hill, near the Fort Canning Gate, a slender, long-haired, silent young models in floaty dresses, surrounded by photographers. I counted five groups one hot, thundery afternoon. Flights of mossy stairs wind up the hill. There are joggers and sightseers, though many Singaporeans find visiting it just too hot and don't quite get why I'd like to talk on-site, with the steep climb and the humidity, the shrill crickets and the risk of thunderstorms and downpours.
For me at least, because I'm participating in Institute as an artist, a lot of it had to do more with my physical kind of interaction with the hill. In the computational age, you know, the 21st century, where seeing a place like on a Google map and sort of believing that what you see on a screen is really that place. My physical interaction with the hill, well, firstly, it's 60 meters off the ground, so every time I walk up, I need to like walk up like easily
200 of steps.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be the first level. I felt it very, very strongly. By the time I reached the hill, I would be drenched, totally drenched. So I felt that it is interestingly very refreshing because most of Singapore is pretty much air-conditioned. And because of the city building, like hills had to be leveled to make way for infrastructure. So the feeling of perspiration at that kind of intensity is actually quite unique. Yeah, so that is an experience that I tried to capture.
So in the performance, you had a big sheet of white paper and yeah. You actually mic'd up the table on which this white paper sat, and then you did sweeping graphite movements as well as hundreds of impacts where you were banging that graphite onto the paper, and it made me think of the millions and billions of footsteps that have trodden onto this hill.
I felt very compelled to sort of change my relationship with the surface, and I guess that's how the idea for that performance came about.
Right on top of the hill is a white wall which surrounds the reservoir supplying the city's drinking water. There's a serious fence as well, Signs on the fence have illustrated figures that show quite clearly you'll be shot if you approach the water source. But there's no trace anywhere on the hill of the stream that legend has it was once a bathing place for the Royal Malayan Court.
A tango of dragonflies buzzed inches above the water to the left of her as she strained to hear the sound again. Nothing.
She watches the water slipping across the worn rock surfaces. Lulled by the ripples, she allows herself to relax, humming beneath her breath a song from her childhood. She missed home. It is hard to tell time here. Time either creeps along or passes in frantic bursts.
Why was it called the Forbidden Stream?
At that time, it was the king's ground. It was for his pleasure, where he and his wife and consorts would bathe, and therefore no one else was to come to this royal spa. But the other part for me, the idea of the stream, besides the fact that it was lost, you know, that we don't know where the source or where it is anymore, whether it really even existed, maybe it did not, was about disappearing histories. History is very much a negotiated space for me. History isn't something that is fixed. It is told from a particular perspective. It is told by deciding which elements actually are associated with each other, what is significant and what to exclude. So it's very much that sort of a dynamic consciousness.
The artists I talked to in Singapore the week I visited said the city felt optimistic and upbeat. Lee Kuan Yew had just declared he'd step out of the cabinet to reduce his influence on his son, the current Prime Minister, Lee Hsien Loong. This after the PAP had lost several seats and an unprecedented 4 out of 10 Singaporeans had voted for other parties. An element of Singapore culture, to keep quiet and not risk unsettling the delicate state of the new nation by exploring challenging ideas, may be on the wane. And with it, Robert Yeo's fear factor, which had, even for me, played an insidious role in my initial thinking about theatre, history, politics and Singapore.
That was Gretchen Miller, exploring history, theatre and politics in Singapore. You heard music from Kanding Ray, who was part of the in-situ performance. And you can check out a photo gallery and access the transcripts of the Barling Talks on our website, abc.net.au/rn/360. Thanks to the Singapore Arts Festival, Robert Yeo, Audrey Koh and June Tan for their help with this program.